Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
The Word is proud media partner of Latitude Festival.
You're listening to a podcast from The Word.
Reading left to right, I'm David Hepworth, this is Mark Allen, and this is our guest, Simon Armitage, please.
Yes! Excellent.
Going to be doing a number of these conversations, chats, over the weekend, some of which are going to be podcasts, wordmagazine.co.uk. Simon, you've been in the poetry tent.
I've done my reading. That's what
done
we call
your reading.
It. Yeah, my reading.
I wasn't sure whether to call it performance or not. Do you ever think about whether you should call it performance reading or?
It's a bit of a sticky one that because within the poetry world, performance has a particular meaning. It's about a particular type of work, and some people think that performance poetry and this other thing called literary poetry should never come together. I'm not really sure what the division is, but it does have a specific meaning,
right?
Because it comes with a capital P.
Yes, of course. Yeah. You expect something. But so your reading went well?
Yeah, it was. It was absolutely fantastic. I've read here twice before, and the first time I was very nervous about it because I thought this cannot work. Poetry needs silence, really. A Scottish poet once described it as the interrogation of silence, and you don't need much else. You don't need a backbeat, you don't need a catering wagon, but you do need it to be quiet. And I thought, I'm going to start up reading some Precious Little Piece, and then Metallica are going to be playing in the next...
Yeah, that huge generator fires
but
up.
But actually, it's just about people listening, and people come along and they sit in that tent, and it's very, very popular in there. I think particularly at this festival, it's... It's just very various, isn't it? Here, what goes on, and it's more than just music. Am I spouting their catchphrase or something?
The question we're asking everybody who we talked to this weekend is what's your first memory of a festival, either going to one or reading about one or seeing it on the TV or whatever?
Definitely my first impression of a festival was seeing footage on TV at Woodstock,
right?
And thinking, why would anybody want to go there? I think in my mind I got it mixed up with Vietnam. There were stories about helicopters
very
dropping hard-boiled eggs on people. I thought, that is not going to defeat the Viet Cong. that's not the way to go about it. But my first experience of a music festival was a place called... a thing called Futurama in Leeds.
Oh, right, yeah.
In a great... I think it was called the Queen's Hall.
The Queen's Hall. It used to be a tram...
That's right, it was a tram shed, wasn't it?
That's an indoor event, though, isn't it? There's no suffering or no camping misery.
I don't know about no suffering.
Maybe it was suffering.
They were suffering the year that the Bay City Rollers played.
You went to that?
Mainly on their part, I think. Yeah,
were the Bay City Rollers booked ironically on
they
them?
They were booked ironically, but I...
Were they informed
wasn't
of the fact
they'd
been booked ironically?
Did helicopters drop eggs on them again?
No, they didn't. But it was... I went 2 years running, I think. Yeah, it was indoors, but it was exciting. I was only like 16, 17, 18, something like that.
So was that old Bill Nelson, Bebop Deluxe?
Bill Nelson, it was Comsat Angels,
right.
It was Red Lorry, Yellow Lorry.
So it's pretty much all of Yorkshire's groups were all in the Queen's Hall.
It was everybody that you wanted to see at the time, to
Robert
be honest.
Palmer?
Well, actually, yes. I think Robert Palmer did play.
I think it was a Yorkshire event going on. He wasn't invited.
Came from Batley.
Batley.
Batley's finest.
Yes.
Batley's known locally as Tattoo Town.
Going back to Woodstock, what was your favourite? You must have seen Woodstock on the telly. Everybody's seen Woodstock on the telly.
Yeah.
What was your favourite bit?
It was the eggs.
The eggs.
Was that better than Canned Heat or Sly and the Family Stone?
Am I misremembering this? The Who played. And didn't Roger Daltrey bang somebody in the head with the end of his guitar and then describe it as some of your actual English violence?
Yeah, I'm
not saying that was my favourite bit, but
it didn't play very well at the great
Peace
and Love Convention.
Yeah.
But what about festivals? I mean, just any more that you went to and camped and, you know, you follow that kind of track in your life?
I can't remember any great highlights, particularly until I started going to Glastonbury. And I had a big...
Which was the first Glastonbury you went to?
Well, I had a big hiatus because I went to one, and I think it was the last year when the wall came down, and I didn't enjoy it. There was a bad atmosphere there. There was just like gangs of scallies roaming around, and did not feel like, you know, the peace and love experience that you were talking about. So I didn't go for about another, I don't know, maybe 12 years. I went last year, and it was wonderful because it was so warm.
Were you performing there?
No, I wasn't, and that was good as well. For everybody.
Now, Simon's got a novel approach to camping at Latitude this year, which he'd like to share with you.
Yeah,
can you admit
this is something
this?
That I shared with you in private, Dave, but I am willing to...
We'll tell you where Dave's spending the night tonight in a minute as well.
Yeah, we pretend to camp. What we do is we come along and we put up a tent and make lots of noise about it and, you know, bang pegs into the ground. Not just bang them into the ground, but countersink them. You know, we really make a good job.
Yeah.
And then when it gets dark and people have fallen asleep, we sneak off.
Then they go in one side and come out under the little buggy takes them to the car park.
It started really because when our daughter was younger, she really always wanted to camp out, and so we'd put her in the tent, she'd fall asleep, and then when she nodded off, pick her up and nip off. But camping's great. It looks great. It's very pretty.
It looks great.
And I like the whole sort of the curtained light that you get in a tent. And but up in the performers' campsite where we used to be, it used to get pretty raucous. And I'm not going to pretend that I'm a young man.
Okay, fair enough. No, you're among friends.
Now I have to ask you about. It's just such a fantastic story. You formed a group. Well, no, you didn't quite form a group.
Yep.
But about 25 years ago. Yep. I read a wonderful article you wrote where you were talking about you and your friend living in what you described as being abject poverty in some sort of place with a 3-bar electric fire, some student sort of miserable den with blankets over you and toast. Yep. And you're trying to write songs. Because you wanted to form a group and be musicians. There's a lovely quote where you said that you realised that writing songs was like trying to ascend at the north face of Everest with only a stepladder and a ball of string, and how impossible it was.
It wasn't just about writing songs. It was about trying to make a record. That's what seemed impossible at that time. We didn't have any equipment. We didn't have any contacts. We didn't have any talent.
And that held a lot of people back.
You know, for all the progress that we made, we probably, you know, didn't have any desire either. But we certainly... Music was our life then, you know. Going to gigs, talking about music, buying records, buying albums, talking about albums all the time.
So records and, by who? What kind of people were you talking about?
Well, oddly enough, this is myself and my friend Craig Smith that I'm talking about. Orange Juice with a big thing in our life. We idolised them. We tried to get everything they'd ever breathed on. You know, the postcard stuff, the original stuff.
And Collins played just an hour ago.
Well, exactly. I was reading poems, and suddenly at about 1 o'clock, the falling and laughing started wafting across the site. And it was very frustrating because I wanted to go over there and listen to him, you know, because, you know, he's a great story as well and a great sort of comeback and everything like that. But, yeah, that all that stuff and Aztec Camera and Joseph K to a lesser extent. Felt were a big band for us as well, so, you know, we were trying to emulate, and we were...
So you just thought, I've got to form a group, make a record, it's an important thing to do, even though I've got no musical experience at all.
Brain surgery looked unlikely as a career. Football had turned its back on us. and the next possibility... Craig is hugely musically talented. You know, he's in the band. He is the musician.
Right.
What was your role? If he was a musician, what did you feel your role was?
I wrote the words. Yeah, lyricist.
All right, lyricist.
Yeah,
right. Good.
Yeah, and I was getting the singer. Yeah.
The Morrissey to his Ma. Let's pitch it like that.
Thank you, man. Because they hadn't come along at that time, but yeah, we were the forerunners of that idea.
They stole it all off
So you. So how did you start?
Group,
naming the group was the kind of first thing, wasn't it?
We went through all that. We wrote songs. We made some little tapes, and never went any further than that. And then What Mark's talking about is that, you know, 25 years later, Craig rings up one day, catches me in a susceptible moment and says, you know that band that we were going to form, why don't we do it now?
We're getting the band back together.
You know that band that we never got together? Why don't we get them back together?
Yes! That's a novel approach.
It's a really good idea.
And there's this wonderful thing that you wrote where you're trying to choose a name. And, the Cagoules was 280s. Yeah. The Zoenans, or is too easily mispronounced. The Autodidacts, too self-conscious. The Has-Beens, too deprecating. The Late Lamented.
Too accurate.
I love this. And so you wrote this whole piece about how agonising it was to try and think of a name. Because it's true, because the more you analyse it, if the Beatles or U2,
but it's the most important thing. It's the most important thing to you when you're forming a band, what you're going to be called, because that's announcing and advertising who and what you are to the whole world as you see it. And in fact, you're advertising to nobody in particular. But we constructed a list of 350 names. 350 names. Yeah, there were things like
long piece of paper.
A close call was the Lemsip Junkies.
The Lemsip Junkies. Yeah. What does everybody think? Does everybody think that they went wrong? Should he have called them the Lemsip Junkies? Anybody think?
Well, they were quite
not
right, because we didn't.
Support here from the Word Lounge.
Taliban haircut.
That's good.
I don't know, we felt a bit nervous about that. The Wheelie Bins we thought was a bit 80s kind of sort of pop.
It's so indie.
Exactly, yeah, that's, yeah.
You should have been on with the Field Mice and
it comes with
Catherine
its own,
Wheel.
It comes with its own fringe. The Wheelie Bins. But then my dad, when my dad got wind of the fact that we were forming this band, he thought that Midlife Crisis was the name.
And there's no answer to that, really.
No.
You're banged to rights, probably. Yeah. But you formed the band.
We formed the band. We made an album. We played Latitude
about
2 years ago.
In fact, the band was, to reveal the name of the band.
The Scaremongers.
The Scaremongers, which is quite a good name, isn't
it? Yes, everyone's shouting and nodding.
Scaremongers,
yeah.
Because after you've thought of 245 other ones, whatever it is, you'd have to... Hopefully.
So how did it presumably it felt really different going on stage as the singer in a group as opposed to going on stage to read your poems?
It felt absolutely terrible. I suppose that the thing about the poetry is that I am the whole thing, you know. I am the resurrection, and I am the... It's all down to me. So if it goes wrong, it's my fault. If it goes well, I get the praise. It's just, they're my poems. I can do what I want with them. But in a band, there are so many variables, and you just can't control them. And the other thing is, that I just felt awkward. I didn't know what to do with my... I haven't got a book to hide behind.
So how did you solve that problem? Did you grab the microphone?
I did a bit of that, yeah. Tried to get as big a microphone as possible so I couldn't really be seen. And
did you lean on the stand?
I did some of that.
Do you privately go and try all these things?
I just didn't know what to do when I went onto stage, and it wasn't good.
Because all those things that look so natural when you see
Liam
Gallagher doing them
are actually...
We've all done that in front of the mirror.
In front of the obviously
stage,
at home, in the privacy of our own home.
Yeah, but
it's fine.
No, it's hard, and I think the thing I struggled with was being at the front, you know, because in lots of ways I was the weakest link in the band. They were all people who could play instruments and read music, and yet I was at the front, and also, you know, because of having some affirmation as a writer, and quite often people came along and they were staring at me. I think because they wanted me to see, you know, they wanted to see me making a fool of myself, and I obliged.
Was it a kind of teenage fantasy though? Is it one of those things that everyone wants to form a group because you hadn't done it, but at least try and do it once?
Actually, I mean, I'm saying all this, it is great fun. It was a bit like being in a five-a-side team, and it was great camaraderie, really great collaboration. Just fantastic fun, everybody getting together and making something. You know, it felt quite old-fashioned. And the other thing was that we didn't have any aspirations about becoming huge. You know, it was too late, and so there was no pressure. So it was just about indulgence. And, you know, we made an album that I was very proud of. And I said to Craig, you know, I don't think that, you know, we've necessarily contended, but we've taken part. way. You know, and we've produced this thing called an album, which is an art artifact that over the years we've revered.
And that's the thing that's important to you, is the physical
thing.
Yeah. I noticed week that Adele's album was the first album to sell a million copies on download in the United States.
Really?
Yeah. And you thought to yourself, in 20 years' time, will anybody be looking back on that? Partly because it's just something in the air. It's not a thing you can hold.
My guess is that there's a whole generation of people, and it's the same with books as well, that, you know, don't value these things as possessions, as things that they need to hold. They come along, they use them, they have a function, and then they go past. And if they need them again, they don't retrieve them, they go and get them again.
As a poet, I think we should ask you about lyricists. Yeah. And which lyricists you think are the most poetic, if that's a reasonable way to put it.
Yeah.
Which particular songwriters were you kind of drawn to?
I was drawn to people like Paddy McAloon from Prefab Sprout. I always thought he was incredibly dexterous and interesting and witty. Wit, I think, is the key ingredient. You know, if you can be humorous and sort of laugh at yourself as well, and make a rhyme that's probably a bad rhyme sound good, but have a bit of a wry smile at the same time. So, I mean, obviously,
does that make you a Leonard Cohen supporter?
I've never been into Leonard Cohen. No. But the big thing for me is always about insisting that none of these people are poets. They are not poets. I'm not having that. You know, they haven't put the work in.
So Bob Dylan, not a poet.
No, not a poet. No, and in fact, sometimes.
Oh, that's interesting. Why?
Well, because the thing that he makes comes with this thing called music. Which is ineffable. It's so difficult to describe what music means. But the song lyrics are made to go with a tune and also a vocal delivery and a performance and an image. Poetry has very little of all those things. It just has words on a page, and all that stuff has got to be written into the language. And sometimes to prove that point, I'll get a Bob Dylan lyric and I will take it into class and we will look at it naked and shivering on the page. And it's actually everything that a poem should not be.
Go on, give us an example.
Cheesy rhymes, mixed metaphors, hypermetric syllables. It's just you can point to everything in a Bob Dylan lyric and say, never write a poem that
does
that. You
see, he very rarely goes on stage, a load of people, angry people in the front, go, it's a mixed metaphor. Rubbish.
It
works as rock music.
Exactly. Rock music isn't made to have the spotlight of literary criticism shone upon it.
Yeah, yeah.
So that doesn't work either. But this is just to say, you know, I'm just staking out a bit of poetic ground, you know. We spend a lot of time making.
I'm not
going to have people who make albums come along and say, oh yeah, we're poets as well.
I think this is.
But it's kind of patronising when they say about Bob Dylan, they say he's so great, he's a poet.
Well,
as if he was a higher state of being.
It's a compliment to poets that, you know, that people should want to shove Bob up into that category. And, of course, what he does is poetic, and he has poetic skills, but the lyrics are not poems.
Right. What's your favourite...
What's your definition of poetic, sorry? It's just supercharged in the way it's expressing itself, or...?
What's my definition of God? This is difficult. I mean, every time you create a definition for a poem, somebody comes along and writes a poem that defies that definition, but it's a piece of language existing in zero gravity. How about that?
That's very good.
Yeah, that's at least two people nodding.
I think Bob Dylan said on a sleeve note, actually, many, many years ago, a poem is anything that can walk by itself, didn't he?
Yeah,
which is a bit similar.
His lyrics can't walk by themselves.
Therefore, he was talking about poems being different things.
The Bob Zimmerman frame of music to go in.
That's low, isn't it? The word lounges. In fact, Gareth, we're going to take some questions in a moment. So if you want to wonder, Gareth is here with the microphone. So if anyone has any questions. Just very quickly, though, you've been very, I think, a strong association, strong support for Alex Turner of Arctic Monkeys.
Yeah.
Why would you go? I must admit, I'm a massive admirer of his.
Yeah.
Why do you rate him so highly?
I think because of what I was talking about, you know, he's witty with the lyrics, and he's got a great feel for language, and I like all the kitchen sink stuff as well. I've always liked that. I think at the time when I first started getting into music, which was the back end of punk, song lyrics were essentially slogans. You know, they were brash loud slogans that didn't do much linguistically. And before that, lyrics had been very pompous and overblown. And bands came along after that that were really sort of nitty gritty and singing about the detail of people's lives. And that's the kind of stuff that I admire in poetry, and that's the kind of stuff that I admire in song lyrics as well. So you know, Alex Turner is always going to be up my street. I've been slightly disappointed, I have to say, with the last couple of albums with the Arctic Monkeys. I'm not quite sure where they're going. I'm not quite sure that they know where they're going.
They're working in a great tradition, sort of a Ray Davis, Squeeze.
I just thought the production on that last album was very sludgy.
I don't know if we can comment on the production.
What, because you're not allowed to, are you?
No, legally allowed.
Oh, OK. Well, perhaps I'm not either, so maybe you better raise that bit
up. I saw Gareth come running back, turning up the volume. Is the microphone working?
Yes, I think it is.
A question for the man in the tremendous hat, please.
Thank you very much. I just like to share with Simon, I in my Latitude schedule this morning, I put two X's, one against Edwin Collins and one against Simon Armitage. Guess which one I went to?
Go on, tell me.
I was at the Royal Court in 1983 watching Orange Juice, put it that way, in Liverpool, that is. I'd just like to stake a claim for lyricist as poet for Cole Porter. Discuss.
Oh. Yeah, actually, some of Cole Porter's lyrics have ended up in poetry anthologies as well. That's not a bad shout, actually. Yeah, he's almost a poet.
None of us are confident enough to separate Cole Porter from Rodgers and Hammerstein. And
which particular?
I don't want to
Cole
do anything
Porter
terribly wrong. Night and Day. Is that Cole Porter? Okay.
Two Sleepy People?
I've no idea about Two Sleepy
Is
People.
That a Cole
Absolutely
song?
No idea. Gentlemen over here.
Picking on a Wishbone from the Frigid Air. What a great song.
Hi, Simon. I was just wondering, when you said about Dylan not being a poet, what about Jim Morrison?
No, definitely not Jim Morrison.
Oh,
no.
Yes. Well, if you don't like Bob Dylan, you're not going to get Jim. That's low. That's bad.
Yeah. No, well, how do you...
No,
how
that's
do, how
fighting
do,
talk.
I want to know how this gentleman feels about it.
Jim Morrison was a great poetic character.
But he wrote poems as well, not just songs, didn't he? A lot of poetry published.
He certainly wrote a lot.
That's not writing, that's typing.
Hi, just to sort of take that bit further, obviously you don't think lyricists are poets, but how do you feel about your poems being performed to music like Kid has been performed to the Batman theme music?
By and large, it doesn't work because poems have their own score written into them, and it's a very... The cadencing within a poem, when it's not actually a rigid meter, is a very complex thing, but it carries the sense of the poem. And if you start tampering with it, then not just the structure of the poem becomes fragile, but the meaning as well. So quite often, the people who've got hold of my poems and turned them into lyrics have had to fight against those inbuilt rhythms, and so they're really fighting against what the poem is trying to do in the first place. And also, they're usually rock and pop people, and most rock and pop music comes with a steady rhythm, you know, a beat, and those are not poems which have beats. Sometimes, you know, every now and again somebody will send me something and I think, well, that kind of works, yeah, but usually they're whatever they're doing it in the wind. Or into the wind, I think the saying might be.
Any more questions? Quite a few, actually. Oh, sorry, it's the
Jim,
same man who
Jim
asked
again.
The question about Jim Morrison. Jim, another question from you. You're coming back, so 15 all, and you're served.
You've upset me now.
The ceremony is about to begin.
This is completely different, actually. I was just wondering, when you write some of your poetry, such as An Accommodation, and obviously there's a lot of diexics and things in there, do you write with a plan to use, obviously because accommodation's a lot to do with spatial diexics and things like that, do you write with that in mind, or do you write almost unaware of those so much diexics?
Well, I like to think that I know what I'm doing. I think at some level I have a plan in terms of what the poem is setting out to do, what, you know, what its significance is, the subject that I'm describing, its inner subject.
beyond that, you have to dive in and then start readjusting lots of little moments within the poem. But by the end of a poem, when I'm printing and publishing something, I like to feel as if I've been in control of every atom of that poem. It's impossible that, you know, to extend the influence of a poem just as you'd imagined it. It's going to have another effect on somebody else because they bring a, you know, a different universe to that poem. But you can try. You know, words have dictionary definitions, unlike notes in a song, and so you can try and exert some kind of influence or impression through a poem. They have an architectural and designed ambition.
So it's your definition of good poetry with an obvious meaning, because I'm starting to think it probably is, because it's going back to the Bob Dylan thing. A lot of the criticism of Bob Dylan is it's not always obvious what he's trying to say.
I like obscure poetry as well, like avant-garde poetry, even like some French poetry, but it's poetry is a broad church, you know, there's lots of different kinds of it, and the poetry that I write and that I've been talking about isn't always the poetry that I want to read, you know, just as presumably Morrissey doesn't want to sit down and listen to Morrissey. Oh, that's probably not a good example.
He's probably doing it right now.
Doing it right now.
It's interesting contrast. Interesting contrast with a songwriter, though. And I'm interested in how you found things different within a group. Because a pop songwriter will often say, I don't know where that came from. Yeah. It just came through me. It just occurred to me. And that their process of composing will be very often trying to stay out of the way of whatever is coming through them.
Yeah.
Did you find that with writing lyrics for your group?
No, I was the same. I was very sort of anal about it.
Right.
And also, I found it difficult at first. I mean, I've written lots of song lyrics for lots of different projects, for films and for documentaries and all kinds of stuff, but my initial temptation is to be very wordy. You know, song lyrics don't require that because they're working in combination with music, which can make what on paper would be a very facile statement become very powerful. And this is an example that I've given a few times when I've been talking about it, but one of my favourite song lyrics of all time, it's not a song that I particularly like, but you two have a song called, I think it's called Who's Going to Ride Your White Horses? Do you know that song? And there's a line in it which is, hey now, shalala, hey now, shalala. It's beautiful. It's absolutely wonderful. And the reason it's wonderful is because there's, I think, a chord change somewhere in the middle of it. Now, you couldn't write that down in a poem.
It probably never was written down.
Yes, it was instinctive, I think, is what you're saying. Yeah. But it is a great moment in that song. And it feels important. But you try and replicate that in a poem. Couldn't do. You have to do it with language. You can't just do it with somebody moving their finger up the bass guitar.
So your group project, is that done now, or
we're very underground.
Right.
Very underground.
Deliberately so?
Largely because there's eight of us. Actually, every time I turn around on stage, there's a few more in the band.
That's a good sign. You mean like Principal Edward's Magic Theatre?
So there's eight of us now, and we represent every corner of the country. So we're sort of masterminding our next rehearsal at the moment. But no, you haven't heard the last of us yet.
Gareth, have we got any more questions in the crowd here? I can see somebody waving at the back there.
Hello.
You, sir.
You talk about poetry as if it's quite a technical thing, and I don't know whether you're a father or not, but, you know, if a small child comes to you with what they would call a poem, I mean, you know, would you say it's full of rhymes and metaphors? It's not poetry, that's rubbish. I mean, basically, my point is, how would you mould and shape or encourage people who don't view poetry as you do or don't have the technical nous that you do?
Well, I was only describing poetry as it applies to me when I'm making it. But, I mean, yeah, I'm not a monster. You know, if a child comes along, I'm not going to sort of give him F.R. Levy to read and to tell him to come back next week. It's... my encouragement is to say to people that the poetry is very probably the oldest art form in the world. It's from as long ago as we could grunt. If we grunted in a particular way, then that became a sort of form of poetry.
Seamus Heaney once described poetry as an anthropological necessity, and I wasn't always sure what he meant, but I think he's just saying as long as there is language, there will be poetry. And the great thing about poetry is that you don't need anything apart from language, and that is a free gift. It's something that you're given when you're born and as you grow up. It's not a huge, convoluted, complicated operation. So anybody who wants to express themselves in some condensed form is writing a form of poetry. If you want to go on and publish that and have it criticised and etc., 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 then it becomes a different thing. And actually, as soon as you decide to publish work, you cross a Rubicon then. You're not writing just for yourself, you're writing for other people. And that's when it's applicable to start, you know, making these criticisms. But, God, no, I mean, you know, I am one of poetry's greatest campaigners. I want everybody to be involved, so long as it doesn't, you know, so long as there's not too much competition.
There was a strange turn of events in the fate of poetry very recently. We were just talking about it before we came on, actually, which is that currently outselling Harry Potter, the Harry Potter app, is T.S. Eliot's The Wasteland app. Explain what's on it.
How's the app work?
It's extraordinary. Will you get readings of The Wasteland by Eliot?
They're my publisher. It's Faber. And I went into their offices a few months ago, and they said, we've just had this app delivered by these amazing guys in Clerkenwell, and it's for The Wasteland, it's for T.S. Eliot's Wasteland. And they were really excited about it. And so they pulled it up on an iPad, and it's the script, the text of The Wasteland.
You can original draft with all these.
Well, you can highlight various bits of it, and then it'll take you to the original manuscript. You can highlight bits of it, and you can get Eliot reading it, another version of Eliot reading it, Alec Guinness reading it, Seamus Heaney reading it, Ted Hughes reading it,
Fiona Shaw
acting it. You can watch it on half screen while Fiona Shaw does her dramatisation of The Wasteland, and it scrolls down at the same time. You can see Ezra Pound's notes on it. You can see scholarly notes on it. It's just the whole package, and they were blown away, and I was blown away. And you know, you think, what is the future of publishing? It's I mean, the possibilities just seem sort of limitless, really.
On that bombshell,
outselling Harry Potter. bombshell.
Go figure.
We've got time for one more question. Anyone else? A quick question? Yes, over here. The man with the hat again. Can I ask you what your badges say? You're wearing two badges.
Yeah, one of them's the Jamie Reid Sex Pistols graphic design, and one of them says Billy No Mates. And the third one I had was the Yellow Submarine, which I've given to my friend's son.
Very Latitude.
Absolutely. Just a quick question for Simon. You know, you're widely considered one of the country's probably best-known poets. And you've sort of crossed over a little bit into music, as in musicians, do you ever feel the pressure in that difficult third album that, you know, musicians make? Seriously, do you feel like, you know, you're established now and you have to write more poetry, and do you feel, you know, that pressure to do more really good work bearing down on you? Now you're sort of quite well known.
I think the pressure is to refresh your voice in some way. You know, you don't want to feel as if you've been droning on for 20 years. And the last book I published, a book called Seeing Stars, was very different for me. They were described in some papers as prose poems, in some papers as flash fiction, in some papers as not poetry. But I was sort of chancing my arm a little bit with that, and, you know, taking a bit of a sort of wild shot. I think that's the challenge, to try and stay alert to language, you know, and alert to the changes that are going on in your life. But the difficult third album, that was quite a long time ago for me now. Album number 33, I might be more worried about.
Thank you so much for coming on. Can we have an enormous Word Lounge hand for the great Simon Armitage? Thank you.
The Word Podcast. Fix yourself a drink and it's like being in the pub.
Can I start by asking, can you remember the first festival you went to or were aware of?
Oh, definitely. My first festival I ever went to was Tea in the Park.
Right.
And it was in 1996. Oh, I'm so old.
It was
incredible. I'd managed to get a job as a backing singer in a band called the Scooby-Doo Orchestra, whose lead singer is now King Creosote.
Right.
And so we all went in a transit van, and it was Radiohead and Beck and the Cocteau Twins, and it was, it totally blew me away. I was amazed.
So how far down the bill were you on that occasion?
I don't even know if we were on the bill.
You just,
I think,
snuck
we were
in
just we were like a little kind of a little whisper,
right,
just off the bottom of the bill.
Yeah.
No, I mean, the Scooby-Doo Orchestra were quite popular at the time in Scotland. I remember we played at the Cayley Tent, so it was a lot of traditional Scottish music, and they were a kind of original penned bluegrass style band, so it's kind of like punk Cayley. It was great.
So what have you learnt about festivals from doing them, from playing them?
I've learnt that people are really nice when they go to festivals. People who are usually really horrible to each other and like don't let each other go first through doors suddenly become incredibly empathic, friendly people. And it's, I think that's such a valuable experience for people to get together over a weekend and just leave any bad attitudes behind. That seems to be what happens, that it's just a kind of a catalyst of people really enjoying being with other people that they don't know, which is usually some people's worst nightmare.
Do you ever suspect when you, I agree with you actually, but sometimes when you see people covered in woad with hair extensions, juggling and things, you think, I wonder what they do normally. Maybe they work, they're going back on Monday to work for the Royal Bank of Scotland or something. You know, maybe they just really are just liberated by the festival experience.
I think, you know, the whole tradition that's kind of growing of dressing up and just letting your hair down even more, I think that's kind of, that's definitely an attitude that's sort of becoming more, it's not very British, you know.
No, it's true.
To dress up, unless it's an occasion. And I think that that's kind of making it even more fun that festivals are kind of developing areas. I mean, Latitude's great for it already, but somewhere like Glastonbury, you could easily go there now and not see any music and have an incredible 5 days. And I think that festivals are starting to really appreciate that the kind of the more underground stuff, the more interesting kind of on the,
all happening, you know, in the fringes,
just
up in the hills.
The kind of more eccentric artistic pursuits are now kind of really valid at festivals.
So what about festival experiences? So great moments of groups that you've seen.
Great moments at festivals. I think the White Stripes at Glasgow was very, very special. And I think also because one of my pet hate questions is in interviews is, so what are you pulling out the bag for today's gig? And I'm just like, whatevs, I'm just doing a gig. Like, I'm going to, every festival, I'm going to get my band together and, like, do some choreography per festival. But, you know, so there's a bit of pressure on you to sort of do something unbelievable, you know, wear something mental. And actually, I'm a real subscriber to just getting on stage and really getting into it and doing a great show. And that's my gig.
But presumably you have to change that for the fact that it isn't your crowd. It's everyone's crowd, isn't it?
Definitely.
Some of them come see you and some of them just
wander
past.
As a performer, that's sort of really nice because there's less responsibility on you to sort of carry the whole thing. They're not, you know, people are paying to see tons of people, so you can sort of be a bit irreverent, which is nice. But seeing the White Stripes, it was just incredible seeing two people with a backdrop just really wipe the floor with a lot of other gigs.
I saw
seen.
That
it
show
incredible.
And it was unbelievably loud, what I remember.
Really,
I couldn't believe
loud.
Two people could make so much noise.
I know, I think if your sound engineer finds the limiter button and how to kind of get rid of that, then I think you're on a winning streak. But what else have I seen? It's been fantastic. I remember seeing Franz Ferdinand at Werchter in Austria, and that was the Europeans love clapping big time.
Love clapping.
They love clapping in time.
Oh, clapping in time.
Yeah.
Oh,
so it's interesting. So you've got to give people something to do, haven't you? It's always my theory of big outdoor gigs. What sort of
thing? I'm very bad at the kind of people on the left sing this. I just like feel like I'm from Butlins or something, and I'm getting better at it because I'm realising that it is actually really it's good fun. But it was at a Werchter when Franz played, and it was just the beginning of Take Me Out, and just the whole crowd, I mean, like 70,000 people are just singing this riff.
And their music is very military tattoos, isn't it? It's very rigid stuff. I can just imagine that. How extraordinary.
It's great.
So when you look down in the crowd, which, you know, you're playing at 5 o'clock tonight, so it's daylight.
Yeah.
Do you fix upon faces?
You try to. Sometimes they're very far away.
Yes.
And you have to kind of... And the really bad thing is, I don't know if this is just human nature or just front person affliction, is that you can always pick the one guy who's really bored and waiting for the next band.
Yep.
who's just like a total geek.
So,
for
so
the
you
next
must get
band.
People who parked themselves there early, not to see you.
Yeah, they don't care about you.
You know that straight away.
Are you just going to go down and give them a happy mask?
They're wearing a Metallica t-shirt
just for your gig. But no, it's you definitely try to get. Hone in because it can, especially when you're on a main stage, it can. I've always found that it can be quite difficult to kind of get the engagement that you get at one of your regular shows because people are literally quite far away and there's security
guards. You've got to reach a long way, haven't you?
But you know, you get there, it's easy.
Do you have to kind of front load the set for an outdoor show? So you've got to have something to get them going.
Good afternoon, Latitude. I'm Katie Dunstall and I am front loading.
It's just a tip for you. You might want to use it.
I might do that. We might just have a little shuffle.
Yeah. And how can you tell?
That's going to be my side band. It's going to be called Front Loader. And all the bands, all the songs at the start will be amazing and they'll just be crap.
And then you just fade away.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, it's Neil Tennant's theory about live shows, isn't it? The first 10 minutes are always the best.
Bono said
for everybody?
I think you probably meant both. Go on.
Bono always says that the first line he records is the most important, and then it doesn't matter as long as you get them in the first line, which is just a microcosmic version of Front Loader.
That's what they all say about Broadway shows. If you have a good opening number, they'll forgive you anything afterwards.
Is it true?
We've got some Gareth is in the audience. This being a live broadcast, Gareth is in the audience, roving with a microphone. So if anybody wants to ask Gareth, in fact, we have a question over here.
Hi, Gareth. What's your mum's name?
What was the first time you can remember sort of really wanting to be a musician, really getting into it, and sort of what were the circumstances around it? Was it someone who influenced you?
It was, to be honest, it probably was King Creoso, who I met when I was about 16, and he took me under his wing, and it was the first time I'd met musicians, and they were just really unwashed and had a brilliant time, and I just thought, this is great. And it was very irreverent, and they were kind of staunchly anti-industry at the time, and it was just really appealing, making your own fortune and making your own life, and I would say probably King Creoso.
So the message is don't wash, people.
Don't wash.
Men. We've got over there. Yes, the girl with the plait.
What does it feel like when you're singing on stage?
Well, sometimes you can be a bit affected by like how you feel that day. So sometimes it's quite daunting when you're going on a big stage and you're just thinking, oh my God, what am I going to do and how am I going to be exciting and... and then other times you don't even think about it and you just get up there. But usually after about 5 minutes, I always feel the same way. And it's just sort of really focusing yourself on getting lost in what you're doing and not worrying about what anybody thinks of it. It's much more about just getting into the songs. And I've definitely, with festivals, got into a habit of jumping up and down a lot and getting very sweaty. And... the problem is that I'll do that it's maybe physical front loading is what we'd call it, where I just start going mental and kind of jumping around, and then you can't really stop doing that, so I end up having to do it for an hour.
Didn't you start as a busker?
You had
a year off in Vermont or somewhere when you were at school,
and
that's very interesting, because actually, I mean, busking, you learn in a way in the deep end how to deal with complicated customers, don't you?
I learned that finger picking tunes really don't get you much money.
No, not much money.
Which
was the song that made you the most money?
Perfect by Fairground Attraction always got me a few coins. But to be honest, I'm really bad at remembering other people's lyrics. So I'd often be playing my own stuff. But that was when I became a rhythm player, because I did start off finger picking, and then you can't be heard. So I just had to sort of teach myself to use a pick and strum. And then you sort of want to be a whole band. And so you're sort of I was using the rhythm guitar as percussion as well.
Well, did anybody here see Katie Tunstall's performance on Later with Jules Holland in 2005.
Just say yes.
Black Horse and the Cherry Tree, and it was incredible. You didn't see it. I mean, she recorded a loop with backing vocal and some percussion on it, and played the guitar and so on. And it was a complete one of those moments where television, complete breakthrough, wasn't it?
Your career went into overdrive
at that point.
Mental rocket pad launcher. It was just really. Really made a huge difference to what happened next.
So, following day, you were recognised, were you?
So you know what? I'm still not recognised. That should happen at some point in my career, but it's not happening yet. It's fine. It's fine by me. But no, it was an amazing moment, and I keep meeting people, and so many people say, "God, I saw you on that thing." I was like, how come everyone seemed to be watching it that night? It was a
It's been on YouTube, isn't it? It's a very big hit. I mean, also you stood in for somebody. I think somebody fell out. And I mean, you weren't brought in at the last minute to do
Nas,
that.
Nas, the rapper, his dad was meant to be playing trumpet, and I think he got flu. I've still not met him, and I'd really like to buy him a shandy.
Buy him a large shandy. Yeah. That's right. I thought so. Gareth, where's our man? We've got another question at the back.
I was lucky enough to first experience Kate when she was 15, playing Anne Frank in the Bayer Theatre, St Andrews. She was mediocre, to be honest. But stick to the festivals. Would you say that that theatrical streak has helped you with your live performances?
Right, everybody. Does everyone want to say hello to Hector? Hi, Hector. How are you doing? Nice to see you.
Like, this is your life, you know, just people from past episodes of your past.
Yeah, no, I have to admit that it was fairly obvious that I should probably go for music rather than acting. It's weird though, because when you start playing music, like you'll be on tour and be absolutely shattered, and do a gig and be in a really bad mood, but you can't go on stage in a really bad mood because that's not what people want. That's not what you want to present to people. And it's that weird sort of bridge between acting and augmenting yourself to be what you want to be. And I think that that's been quite interesting for me, having done acting, to go on stage and sort of be a version of yourself, but still want to be honest with what you're presenting. So... yes, thanks very much, Hector. Lovely.
Thank
you,
Hector. Yeah, that's terrific. Now, we've got a couple more questions at the back there. We haven't got long because, in fact, Katie Tuss is playing the obelisk stage.
I've got to go and do all my eccentric rituals before I play.
Get in the zone, man.
I've got to shave my head and glue all my hair back on before I play.
Which takes time. So we've got to have a couple more questions.
It's probably quite a comp question, but if you could play with anybody in the musical area at any place, which would it be?
Living? Does it have to be living? Really? I would... Led Zeppelin and Fleetwood Mac both massively appeal. So if I could have somehow kind of fitted into their vibe, that would have been good. But I think...
why Led Zeppelin? That's very interesting.
Led Zeppelin, I love...
They are a bit of a folk
fan.
Group on the side.
Well, that's it. They're very... you know, I think they've got this very quintessentially English... thing going on, and a lot of that is folk music, and I think that English folk music is very beautiful. Scottish folk music is obviously kind of more recognisable, but there's something quite subtle and sort of, I don't know, I find it very moving. I love the Watersons and Martin Carthy and Robin Hitchcock, and it's that, and I really think that Led Zeppelin have got this amazing, very, very intimate folk thing down, whilst having these monster riffs and my favourite drummer, John Bonham, favourite drummer of all time. So, and just each of them is so, so perfect at what they do.
And people overlook that stuff, don't they? They're big fans of Pentangle and Bert Jansch.
I just think Led Zeppelin, songwriting and musically and just visually, just so exciting. And but I think... Beck is someone I'm very excited by. I'm not really into collecting everybody's album, so I'll often just listen to one album and then move on to something else. And Beck's someone who I've always listened to everything he's done, and I just love what he does. He'd be fun.
One more question. Yes, please. At the back.
Slightly connected. Saw you a couple of years ago make a guest appearance with C6 Steve.
Oh, yeah.
You came on and played the flute.
Yes.
Any kind of other musical collaborations in the future? Kind of connected before, but anybody you look to record with?
I'm just trying to think if anything's in the pipeline. Steve and I actually, we got on so well. He laughed at me when I said I was going to play flute with him because he thought I was going to crack some tune out from, like, Bandcamp. And but it was a bit of a bluesy number that we did. But we always said that we'd do a bit more together. But no, there's nothing lined up at the moment. But I'm about to do a kind of side project, beats kind of dance oriented album with Jim Abbas, who I just made my last record with. We're going to do a little side project under a different name, and we expect to get a few guests on that. So we'll. you know, there might be a couple of names you'd know as part of that. So we're going to record that in a couple of months and hopefully come up with something listenable.
Thank you very much for coming. What we ought to end with is some tumultuous applause, possibly in the Austrian style.
Yeah. All at the same time.
All at the same time. Thank you so much for coming along. You're on 5 o'clock tonight, and very nice to see you. Thank you.
Okay, cheers. Thank you very much.
If you've been affected by any of the issues in this podcast, go to wordmagazine.co.uk or apply at your newsagent.